Whatever is sold in the butcher's shop, eat, asking no questions for the sake of conscience. He said that they could not share in both the Lord's cup and the cup of devils, and he permanently steered them away from those tables using Jewish examples, human arguments, the profound mysteries, and the ceremonies performed among idols, filling them with great fear. However, he didn't want this fear to push them to the opposite extreme, making them overly cautious, worried that they might unknowingly consume something from the market or somewhere else that's linked to idols. To free them from this dilemma, he stated, "Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising questions." Because, he argued, if you eat unknowingly and not deliberately, you're not subject to the punishment. It's then a matter of ignorance, not of gluttony. He not only frees man from this worry, but also from another, securing them in complete safety and freedom. He doesn't even allow them to question, that is, to investigate or inquire, whether it is a sacrifice to an idol or not, but simply to consume everything that comes from the market, not even learning as much as this, what it is that is served to us, so that even the one who eats, if in ignorance, may be free of worry. For such is the nature of those things which are not inherently evil, but through the man's intention make him sinful. That's why he says, ask no questions. Version 26. For to the Lord belongs the earth and everything in it, not to the devils. Now if the earth and the fruits and the beasts are all his, nothing is unclean, but it becomes unclean otherwise, from our intention and our disobedience. Therefore he not only allowed, but also, Verse 27. If one of the non-believers invites you, he says, to a feast and you want to go, whatever is served to you, eat, without questioning for the sake of conscience. Observe again his restraint. For he didn't command nor create a law that they should remove themselves, but neither did he prohibit it. And again, should they choose to leave, he absolves them of any suspicion. Now, what might be the reason for this? It's so that excessive curiosity wouldn't appear to spring from any fear or cowardice. For the person who meticulously investigates acts as if they're scared, but the one who, upon hearing the facts, refrains, does so out of disdain and revulsion. Therefore, Paul, aiming to affirm both points, says, eat whatever is set before you. But if anyone tells you, this has been offered as a sacrifice to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who pointed it out. So it's not about any power they possess, but rather as cursed, that he advises to avoid them. Don't avoid them as if they could harm you, for they have no strength. But also, don't participate indifferently, just because they have no strength. It's the table of hostile and degraded beings. That's why he said, do not eat for the sake of the one who revealed it, and for the sake of conscience, for the earth is the Lord's, and everything in it. Do you see how, whether he tells them to eat or to abstain, he cites the same evidence? For I do not prohibit, he says, as if they belong to others, but for the reason I mentioned, for the sake of conscience, that is, to avoid causing harm. So should one investigate carefully? No, he says, for I did not mean your conscience, but his. For I have already stated, for the sake of the one who revealed it. And again, in 1 Corinthians 10:29, conscience, I say, not your own, but the other's. However, someone might argue, you naturally protect your brethren and do not let us influence them, fearing that their weak conscience may be encouraged to eat the idol sacrifices. But what if the person is a heathen? How does this person concern you? Didn't you yourself say, what business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? So why then do you seem to concern yourself with them? My concern is not for him, he answers, but also for you in this situation. And he adds to this effect also, why is my freedom judged by another's conscience? Here, by freedom, I mean the liberty to act without caution or prohibition. This is true freedom, liberated from Jewish constraints. What I'm trying to say is this, God has granted me a status above harm or injury, but the non-believer does not understand my way of living or appreciate the generosity of my Lord, but will condemn and conclude Christianity is a myth. They avoid idols. They reject demons, but still engage with the things offered to them. They are excessively indulgent. So what, you might ask? What's the harm to us if they judge us incorrectly? But wouldn't it be better if we didn't give them any basis for judgment at all? If you abstain, they won't even say this. How, you might ask, will they not say it? If they see me not asking these questions, either in the butcher shop or at a feast, what's to stop them from making these comments and condemning me as someone who partakes without discernment? That's not the case at all. You participate not as accepting idol sacrifices, but as receiving pure things. And if you're not keen on scrutinizing, it's to demonstrate that you're not intimidated by what's presented to you. That's why, whether you enter a non-believer's house or go to the market, I advise you not to ask questions so you don't become fearful and confused and give yourself unnecessary anguish. Verse 30. If I partake by grace, why am I criticized for that which I give thanks? What do you mean by partaking by grace, tell me? It refers to the gifts of God. His grace is so immense that it keeps my soul unstained and above any impurity, similar to the sun that sends down its rays on numerous impure spots, withdrawing them again pure. So too we can remain pure living in the midst of the world if we choose to, because our capability is even greater than the sun's. Why then refrain, you ask? Not because I would become impure, not at all, but for the sake of my sibling, so that I don't share with devils, and so that I'm not judged by the non-believer. In this situation, it isn't the nature of the thing that makes me impure, but the disobedience and the association with devils and the intention of the heart creates the impurity. But why am I criticized for something I'm grateful for? He asked. I myself give thanks to God for elevating me above the Jews, protecting me from harm. But the Gentiles, ignorant of my high moral standards, might assume the worst. They could say, these Christians are adopting our customs. They're hypocrites, claiming to despise our gods but attending their feasts. What could be more illogical? We deduce that they converted not for truth, but for ambition and power. How absurd would it be if the blessings I'm thankful for became a cause for criticism? Even as it is, you might say, the Gentile will make these claims when they see me not scrutinizing. Not at all. Not everything is laden with sacrifices to idols to make them suspicious. And you don't consume these offerings, considering them as such. So don't be excessively cautious, but also don't partake if someone claims it to be an idol sacrifice. For Christ has granted you grace and placed you above harm so you wouldn't face censure. The things you're thankful for should not cause others to blaspheme. Wait, why don't I tell the Gentile, I eat and endure no harm, and I don't do this out of sympathy for your gods? Because even if you repeat it 10,000 times, you won't convince them due to their weak understanding and hostility. If your own brother isn't convinced by your words, the foe and the Gentile certainly won't be. If your brother is still concerned about the idol's sacrifice, how much more the unbeliever would be. And really, why should we go through so much trouble? So what then? We know Christ and give thanks while they insult him. Should we then also abandon this tradition? Absolutely not. The situations are not the same. In one case, we greatly benefit from tolerating the insults, but in the other, there's no advantage. That's why it was said before, whether we eat or not, it doesn't make us better or worse. In addition to this, he also demonstrated that this practice should be avoided. Not only for this reason, but also for the other reasons that he provided should they abstain from it. For 31, so whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do you realize how, from the topic at hand, he extended the exhortation to a broader context, offering us the most superior of all goals, that God should be glorified in all things? Verse 32. Don't cause anyone to stumble, whether they're Jews, Greeks, or members of God's church. Meaning, don't give anyone a reason to fault you, because in the given situation, not only is your brother bothered by you, but the Jew will despise and judge you even more, and the Gentile will similarly mock and belittle you for being a glutton and a hypocrite. Not only should our brothers suffer no harm from us, we should also strive to protect everyone else to the best of our ability. If we are a light, leaven, luminaries, and salt, then our job is to bring illumination, not darkness, to bind, not to separate, to attract non-believers, not to repel them. So why would you repel those you should be attracting? Even outsiders are hurt when they see us falling back into familiar traps, as they don't understand our mindset or that we've risen above all sensory pollution. This behavior will also upset Jews and our more vulnerable brothers. Do you see how many reasons he has given for why we should avoid idol sacrifices? because of their uselessness, because of their lack of necessity, because of the harm to our brother, because of the nasty talk from the Jew, because of the ridicule from the Gentile, because we should not associate with demons, and because the act is a form of idolatry. Moreover, since he said, "Give no cause for stumbling," and held them accountable for the harm done, both to the Gentiles and to the Jews, and the statement was difficult, see how he makes it agreeable and manageable, presenting himself and stating, "Just as I also aim to please everyone in all things, not seeking my own benefit, but the benefit of many, so they might be saved." Chapter 11, verse 1, "Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ." This represents the epitome of true Christianity. This is a clearly defined guideline. This is the greatest principle of all. Specifically, seeking those things that are for the societal benefit, which Paul himself declared by adding, "just as I am of Christ." There's nothing that can replicate Christ's spirit more than caring for one's neighbors. Indeed, even if you fast, lie on the ground, or go to extreme measures, but dismiss thoughts of your neighbor, you haven't achieved anything significant. You are still distant from emulating this model. Regardless, in the situation at hand, the action itself is inherently beneficial. That is, refraining from idle sacrifices. "But I," he said, "have done many things that weren't beneficial either. For instance, when I practiced circumcision, when I offered sacrifice. These actions, if analyzed intrinsically, tend to mislead those who pursue them and jeopardize their salvation. Nevertheless, I complied with these for their potential benefits. But this situation doesn't have such conditions. In that situation, unless it provides a specific benefit or done for the sake of others, then it becomes harmful. However, in this case, even if no one takes offense, you should still refrain from the activities prohibited. But I haven't only subjected myself to harmful things, but also to laborious ones. For I robbed other churches," he says, "taking wages from them, and when it was permissible to eat and not to work, I did not seek this, but chose to starve rather than offend another." This is why he says, "I please all people in all things. Even if it's against the law, even if it's laborious and risky, I endure everything for the benefit of others." So even though he was above all in perfection, he became beneath all in humility. No virtuous action can truly be elevated if it doesn't extend its benefits to others as well. This is demonstrated by the individual who returned the one talent intact and was harshly punished because he had not increased it. "And so, brother, even if you should go without food, if you should sleep on the ground, if you should consume ashes and constantly be mourning and do no good for anyone else, it won't amount to much. Just like those great and noble figures in the beginning, they made this their primary focus. Carefully examine their lives, and you'll clearly see that none of them ever focused on their own interests, but rather on the interests of their neighbors, which is also why they shone more brightly. Take Moses, for example. He performed many great miracles and signs, but nothing made him as great as that blessed statement he made to God, saying, 'If you will forgive their sin, so forgive, but if not, erase me as well.' David was the same way, which is why he said, 'I, the shepherd, have sinned, and I have done wickedly. But these, the flock, what have they done? Let your hand be upon me and upon my father's house.' Just like them, Abraham wasn't seeking his own benefit, but the benefit of many. That's why he both put himself in danger and pleaded with God for those who didn't belong to him in any way. Well, these people indeed became glorious. But think about those who pursued their own interests and the harm they encountered. For example, the nephew of the last one mentioned listened to the advice, "If you want to go to the right, I'll go to the left." He chose the path that he thought would benefit him, but his region was burned while the other remained untouched. Take Jonah's case, too. He focused on his personal gains and consequently faced the risk of perishing in the sea while the city remained safe. But when he sought the welfare of many, he also benefited. Similarly, Jacob, not seeking his own gain among the flocks, ended up with abundant wealth. Also, Joseph, caring for his brother's well-being, found his own. Despite knowing that his brothers, who had tried to harm him for his vision and dreams, might again harm him when they got him in their midst, he chose to prioritize his brother's welfare. Consequently, he enjoyed all the good that followed, which made him stand out and admired. Let's take Moses as another example. There's no harm in mentioning him second time. He was living in a king's court, but he valued the reproach of Christ more than the treasures of Egypt. By forsaking all of them, he shared the afflictions of the Hebrews. Not only he did not become a slave himself, but he also liberated them from bondage. Well, these indeed are great things and worthy of an angelic life. However, Paul's conduct far surpassed this. While all others chose to leave their own blessings to partake in others' afflictions, Paul did something much greater. It was not that he agreed to partake in others' misfortunes, rather he chose himself to be at all ends so that others might enjoy blessings. Now it is not the same for one living in luxury to abandon his luxury and endure adversity, as it is for one to endure adversity alone to ensure others' safety and honor. Even though it's a significant act to trade prosperity for affliction for the sake of your neighbor, it still brings some comfort to have others share in the misfortune. Agreeing to be alone in distress so others may enjoy their good things, this signifies a much more resilient soul and is characteristic of Paul's own spirit. And not only by this, but by another and greater excellence does he surpass all those previously mentioned. That is, Abraham and all the others put themselves at risk in the current life, and all these were simply requesting for this type of death once and for all. But Paul prayed that he may forfeit the glory of the future world for the sake of others' salvation. I can also note a third point of superiority. And what is this? That while some people may have interceded for those who plotted against them, it was only for those whom they were responsible for guiding, just like one might defend a wild and lawless son, but still a son. On the other hand, Paul wished to be cursed in place of those he was not entrusted to take care of. He was sent to the Gentiles. Can you see the enormity of his character and the highness of his spirit surpassing even the heavens? Try to imitate this man, but if you can't, at least follow those who were exemplary in the Old Covenant. This is how you'll find your own benefit if you look out for your neighbor's interests. So when you feel reluctant to care for your brother, remember that you cannot be saved in any other way. At the very least, stand up for him and his interests for your own sake. Even though what was said earlier should be enough to make you realize that looking out for your own good is only achievable through collective well-being, if you need examples from everyday life, consider a fire starting in a house. If the neighbors, out of self-interest, avoid facing the danger and lock down their homes in fear of being robbed, they would end up enduring severe punishments. The fire could potentially advance and consume their properties as well. Since they didn't care for their neighbor's well-being, they end up losing their own, too. This happens because God, in his desire to interconnect us all, created a world where one person's welfare is linked to another's. This principle holds true in a ship during a storm. If the captain disregards the passenger's safety and seeks only his own, he will likely end up endangering himself and others. This principle is visible in every profession. If a profession only considers its own profit, neither life nor the profession itself could exist. The farmer, for example, doesn't just plant enough crops for his personal consumption, as that would lead to starvation for himself and others over time. Rather, he considers the needs of the many. A soldier faces danger not just to save himself, but to safeguard his community too. Similarly, a merchant doesn't just import goods for his personal use, but for the many others as well. Now, if anyone says, "Each person does this, not considering my interests, but only their own, for they engage in all these things to gain money, glory, and security, so that in pursuing my profit, they are actually seeking their own," this is also what I say and have long wanted to hear from you. And this is why I have crafted all my words to indicate that your neighbor is indeed seeking their own profit when they consider yours. For since individuals would be unwilling to value their neighbor's things unless they were compelled to do so, this is why God has linked things this way, not permitting them to reach their own profit unless they first navigate through the profit of others. Well then, it's inherent in humans to pursue their neighbor's advantage, but one should be guided not by this reason, but by what pleases God. For salvation is impossible without this. And even if you were to perform the most perfect of deeds and ignore others who are in peril, you won't gain any favor with God. How is this clear? From what the blessed Paul stated, "For if I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing." he says. Do you see what great demand Paul places upon us? And yet, he who donated all his possessions to feed the poor was not seeking his own benefit but that of his neighbor. But according to Paul, this alone is not enough. What he wants is for it to be done with genuine and deep empathy. For this reason, God enacted this law, aiming to engender in us a bond of love. If God demands such a large measure of us, and we don't even offer what's less, how can we hope to deserve any leniency? And how, says one, did God tell Lot through the angels, escape for your life? Tell me when and why. It was when the punishment was imminent, not when there was a chance for correction, but when they were condemned and beyond help, and both old and young were swept up in the same passions, and henceforth they were destined to be consumed by fire, and on that day when the lightning was about to strike. Moreover, this was not about vice and virtue, but rather the punishment inflicted by God. So, what was he supposed to do, tell me, just sit and wait for the punishment and be consumed by fire without helping them at all? No, that would have been the height of folly. For I don't assert this. One should not inflict punishment on oneself arbitrarily or indiscriminately, disconnected from God's will. But when a person persistently commits sin, I urge you to take initiative and correct him, for the sake of your neighbor if you're willing, but if not, at least for your own benefit. Indeed, the former is the better path. However, if you can't reach such selflessness yet, do it even for your own advance. And let no one pursue his own interests with the hope of finding his own welfare, and remembering that neither chosen poverty nor martyrdom nor anything else can vouch for us unless we possess the crowning virtue of love. Let's safeguard this above everything else, so that through love we may also receive all other current and future blessings. May we all reach these blessings through the grace and mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory forever and ever. Amen.